meeting of the Joint Interim Committee on Oregon State Hospital Patient Care to order. Good evening, everyone, and I wanted to welcome you to our fifth and I believe our final meeting of this committee. We have met five times over a period of several months, beginning back in February 1st, in fact, when we met at the State Hospital, and we're really just trying to come to grips with and digest some very discouraging and dire information about what was going on at the hospital. But I think in the ensuing hearings, when we have heard from both staff and patients and new people who have come on board, as well as the Department of Justice and Department of Human Services, and many of those folks you're going to be hearing from again tonight, we have actually made some progress and really are well on the way to starting to turn things around at the hospital. And I know many of the members of this committee have worked very, very hard before the committee even existed on trying to come to grips with the State of Oregon State Hospital. And many of us were at the groundbreaking for the new hospital, which happened just a few days ago, and that was a very hopeful and very wonderful day. So this evening we are going to be getting updates from several of the principals who've been involved in the changes that have been made and what is currently going on at the hospital. We will hear a little bit about the project that is going on with construction of a new state hospital, and we'll also hear from the Oregon Department of Justice on the progress that's being made negotiating with the federal government on the CRIPA action. And then we will finally hear a proposal, I believe, from the superintendent of the hospital. And obviously we will be open throughout for questions and comments from committee members. And then we will try to wrap up by 7 o'clock. So are there any other comments to open with, Mr. Co-Chair? Okay. Well, let's start with Roy Orr, the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, to give us an update on the security plan. Good evening. Welcome back.
Good evening. Co-chairs Rosenbaum and Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Roy Orr. I'm superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. It is my third time, I believe, in front of this committee, and it's nice to be back in front of you. Let me say, in light of your opening comments, Co-chair Rosenbaum, if this indeed is your last committee meeting, I am grateful that the legislature has shown the interest in Oregon State Hospital that it has. It's been obvious to me in these meetings as well as between meetings. In questions you've directed my way, those of you who've taken tours of the hospital in a variety of ways, and I'm grateful for your interest. And I know I speak for all of the employees and believe I speak for the patients at Oregon State Hospital when I say that. I'll start with the security review, as you requested. If I could first, I've tried to strike a balance, and I hope I've done so in providing you and your staff some information in the packets you have in front of you. I hope I've not gone overboard in that regard. There's so much detail behind every effort we have going on at Oregon State Hospital that it's impossible to cover these issues in a succinct manner, though I'll try and do that with highlights of each of these topics that I'll speak to you about this evening. In the first section of your packet is your security plan update reference material, and in it you have the preliminary report. I'll just go through that portion of the packet very quickly, and then I'll get to my comments. The preliminary report, which staff at the hospital, principally the deputy superintendent Maynard Hammer and director of forensic patient services Sue Zakes and Karen Garcia, are relatively new director of security, worked hard to pull together that comprises our largely internal review. Behind that, it's called Appendix A. You have a planning analysis and research report, which is a breakdown of escapes, or we call them unauthorized leads, ULs. You'll see them referred to in that report. That was put together by our planning analysis and research staff, which was part of the CRIPA, or Continuous Improvement Plan, request back in February that you may recall. And a cadre of research folks and analytic staff who are doing extraordinary work for us and taking mountains of data and turning it into meaningful information. So that's in there as well. Behind that is an appendix of 2+ years of escape data or unauthorized leave data, which is referenced in the preceding report. There's also next steps, things that are, most of which are frankly already underway. And the final two items there are proposed scope.
1 second, Mitch. Just so you know, there are a few copies of this in the pile in the back, right, Sasha? You just put them on the back table there in terms of those. Most of you probably have this file, but if there's some more back there, if you want to get one. All right, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Courtney. I don't want to linger on this, but I just, if you want to make notes in the margins, I go through these quickly. The proposed scope of work, the second to the last piece, is, in fact, an external review from the Silva group up in Everett, Washington, which is just getting underway. And the final item, which I'll refer to more later, is a product called START, Short-Term Assessment of Risk and Treatability, something that we're implementing this month. That gives us a much better idea of risks associated particularly with escapes and unauthorized leads. And it's an evidence-based tool, and as I said, I'll talk about that more. So with that as a quick background through the packet, I'm sure all of you will recall that this full review came about as a result of two pretty well-publicized escapes back in early July. It was timely in an unfortunate sort of way in that we had just hired a new director of security in June. And this allowed her, during her orientation period, to really focus her efforts in an area that is probably the epitome of the balance between the healing and recovery work that we do and protecting the public at the same time. So with that in mind, and with her assistance and the others I mentioned previously, we began with internal review that involved reviewing our own policies and procedures, the kinds of things that drive our day-to-day behaviors, our staffing, are we staffed properly on the security side of the organization, our communications with law enforcement, was obvious to us with Mr. Sands' escape back in July, was a problem in that particular incident, and our results indicated that it was a structural flaw, which we've since corrected. We looked at hiring. Are we hiring the right kind of people for the jobs, and what do we do to train them and keep them up to speed? And when I say train, that includes all of our staff, because all of our staff, not just our security staff, are really our frontline security. The external review actually was conducted in two parts. We had the tremendous benefit of a number of people, many of whom you'll all recognize. Raul Ramirez, recently the Marion County Sheriff, and now Executive Director of the Sheriff's Association. Chief Jerry Moore from Salem Police Department, the Oregon State Police, and a number of people from the Oregon State Police have extended support and input and have been very helpful. City Councilor in Salem, Bruce Rogers, who has the neighborhood within which the state hospital resides. all have begun participating in a process that I envision will go on for months to come. And eventually, we will evolve into the continued involvement of the public through our ongoing meetings with neighborhood associations, which are already underway, and regularly scheduled opportunities to meet with law enforcement and our security staff. The second phase of the external assessment involved the Silva Associates I referred to as in the back of this section of your packets. The scope of their work is in there. I want to thank Linda Hammond and the replacement project staff for helping us expedite the process of utilizing external security consultants through the replacement project. Shortens the contracting process and gets them on the ground, which they've already been on the ground for a preliminary meeting. We envision in the next 3 to 5 weeks that we will have the Salem campus evaluated by Silva Associates. We will reconvene Mr. Ramirez and Chief Moore and others for a review of their information. We know that we will have additional staff, some of which you granted us in the February special session, but we'll have additional security staff in our 09-11 policy option package. And then we will also conduct a security review with the Silva company up in Portland, of our Portland campus. The last item in your packet was the START program, the short-term assessment of risk and treatability, and I'll just comment on that briefly. There are a number of staff at the hospital who, through their research throughout the industry, came across this START tool. It is, as it says in the brief overview, a concise clinical guide that will really help us in assessing the risk of our patients as they move through the recovery process toward more and more passes into the community and privilege levels of privileges and ability to move closer to community placement. This is a product that's been in use in Canada and in the United Kingdom. It's evidence-based, and in fact, we start training on the START tool Monday, and we're eager to implement it. Those are the highlights of my comments about our security plan efforts. I would also, I guess, like to mention before I conclude and answer any questions you might have that questions have arisen recently from members of the neighborhoods around our campus. We are committed to continuing any kind of educational efforts. Ms. Hammond, through the replacement project in her own time, as well as Mr. Hammer, attended a neighborhood meeting just last night, as a matter of fact, and spoke directly with many of the folks who have expressed concern about our uses of the cottages. Which you know, those of you who attended our groundbreaking, the restoration of those cottages is actually underway. I think probably most of you as committee members also know that for the last 10 years or so, in fact, they have been used by a variety of forensic-style patients. And I just want this committee to know, and I would want the public to know, that we are committed to doing our due diligence to answer all questions and try and address all concerns that the public has, and we're committed to that process. I'm available for any questions.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. But the phrase structural flaw has been corrected. What was the structural flaw?
Well, I use that. It should be one of the very, very first calls our communication center makes. It should be, if you will, wired to make that call when a patient has left our campus. That's the structural flaw. It's not, I misspoke. It's not an engineering or an architectural thing.
So how much did this need to do the number of staff that was on the floor that night?
Well, it's hard to say, Co-Chair Courtney, due to the fact that you're talking about the Sands incident. because Mr. Sands became more and more aggressive as the night went on. I will tell you that in my view, since we only had two staff members, both of whom I've interviewed personally after this incident, we had three on duty that night on 50C. One was off the ward for the moment, and with two on the ward at that moment, we believe that was a sort of the trigger that Mr. Sands felt he could overpower staff.
So there's 47 people on that.
Yes, sir.
Night shift, everyone. There are two people with 47. Is that it?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's not an unusual sort of a night shift ratio.
Okay. So you had your security report done as early as 3 weeks, no later than five. Is that right?
On the Salem campus. That's correct.
And what about the lockdown? Where are we on the lockdown?
Well, we have. I have probably made our staffing even a bit more complicated in that I have restored some level of privileges for many of our forensic patients, but have increased the staffing ratio with those patients if they're going to move around on the grounds or go to into the community. The number of staff we need to accompany them is much higher than it has been. The last couple of months, we've not had any incidents, and I my hat's off to the staff for their work in that regard. But there are still a lot of our forensic patients who do not have passes. And
you've had them before?
That's correct. And we're getting, clearly we're to the point where many of those patients and their ability to continue moving down a continuum of recovery toward community placement is being hampered as a result of that.
Should I wait to Linda testifies just to ask you about additional tours, or do you want to comment on that?
Ms. Hammond is the, okay, the tour expert.
Thank you very much, Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Orr, we have a document here called the staff.
Correct.
Great looking.
Okay.
What's been done and what's the timeline for the others? I noticed some of these in your report have been completed. And I guess, let's talk further, particularly the last one, how we can answer.
Co-chairs Rosenbaum and Courtney and Representative Berger, thank you for the question. Let me quickly go down that list, if I might. The revision to policies to clarify security procedures is already underway. Many of those policies have already been revised, and we'll bring those back full circle to the law enforcement group, including the city councilor, Councilor Rogers, I mentioned earlier. We also want those revisions to be scrutinized a second time by the Silva group, so that is a process that's well underway, but we'll continue with Silva scrutiny. Training staff on revised policy. Security has already started that. In fact, that was what I referred to as a structural flaw that we don't want to ever commit again. Let me restate that. It was a procedural flaw in that it was far too long before we put a call to Salem PD to alert them that Mr. Sands was off our campus, and we're committed to that never happening again. Working closely with law enforcement and developing those collaborative protocols, each of those I mentioned earlier have been extraordinary in their reaching out to us and their willingness to provide training and do it on an ongoing basis. That will be ongoing, I hope, long after I retire. Holding periodic meetings with law enforcement is part of that.
Have you, in your work group, talked about a regular scheduled system or at some level you're talking to state and police? It sounds like that hasn't happened in the past.
Yeah. That's exactly what we're talking about. Okay. Routine, scheduled meetings for the various law enforcement agencies to come together, and even when we think we don't have something.
Yeah, and if I may tag on to this, I have heard law enforcement in this community also complain about the work of investigations within the institution and this would help a lot if there were better communication.
Absolutely.
The cost of investigating a crime within the institution.
Absolutely.
Is borne by the DA.
And that's in particular that relates to Oregon State Police's role on our campus.
Exactly. Yep. So I'm putting an underline on this for you.
And if I could just drop down to establishing the detailed schedule and tracking mechanism at your convenience and at your request, you're welcome to contact my office directly at any point in time going forward. And we'd be happy to. We'll do this probably in an Excel format that we can ship to you by email and keep you abreast of meetings and changes as they occur. Would you like me to continue through the list?
We're getting the high point. The DHS website piece, post significant information.
Public information. Mm-hmm.
I think I need to address that.
Okay.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. Mr. thank you for your report. I'm your preliminary report regarding the security review. I'd just like to connect it with something that happened last week with the Los Angeles incident that I'm sure all of us are very sorrowful about what happened. But the communications officer got out ahead of the announcement and took responsibility for what happened in the trains. Mm-hmm. And when I look at your findings in your recommendation, number 3 says certify communications center staff to allow for timely entry of temporary felony warrants. I worry about what kind of person. I'm concerned about what is considered timely entry, especially with the neighbors already registering some concerns about the sexual, the felony
offenders,
and then those people who have been displaying very aggressive manner and the. So what is time?
Co-chairs Courtney and Rosenbaum, Senator Carter, that you zeroed in on exactly what we were talking about. Timely is as close to instantaneous as we can make it.
So the police then would be notified, and that is in the whole system.
As soon as we have any indication that somebody is off of our campus, first responders would be Salem Police Department.
Okay.
A close second would be Oregon State Police for an investigation of state property where the patient has left from. Then we have our typical administrative notifications, those kinds of things. But law enforcement needs to know that, in this case, a forensic patient is off our campus and is a priority.
Mr. President and Chair, my concern about this also is that we, as a state, have not done a very good job of working with the police department and giving them appropriate training for how to work with people who have mental illness. And I have too many experiences of things that have happened in the past, and so I hope that as we partner with Marion County Police Department, that we will take that into consideration, because incidences can happen which none of us have any control over, but at the same time, after the fact, we all regret any kind of happenings, and so I'm hoping that we take that into consideration.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. Just a quick question. We focused a lot on the escape or unauthorized leave from the Salem campus and the cooperation of the Salem police and the work. What is being done with Portland? We have more than just the one campus. I know that there's about split 50% unauthorized in Salem and 50% unauthorized in Portland. So are you receiving the same kind of cooperation with the Portland Police Department as you're receiving from the Salem Police Department?
Co-chairs Rosenbaum and Courtney, Senator Winters, thank you for your question. And you zeroed in on Appendix B and the fact that, in fact, disproportionately a majority of our escapes or unauthorized leaves do, in fact, come from the Portland campus. We have no security staff at the Portland campus, to be candid. And that is a glaring historic omission. We have staff, but they're clinical staff and communication staff, but we do not have security staff at the Portland campus. It has not historically had security staff. I know that reaching out to the Portland police is on our security director's agenda and very high. We have focused some of our most intensive efforts on the Salem campus, but rest assured that Portland's high on our on her list and my list as well.
Is also high on your list, then, since there is no security staff on your Portland campus, and since, you know, if you look at statistically, that Portland actually has more unauthorized than Salem.
Right.
Are your plans to talk about increasing your security staff? And it would also be helpful to have some idea of what the background of those individuals that are the unauthorized categories.
Yeah. Co-chairs Rosenbaum and Courtney, Senator Winters, let me answer that a couple of different ways. We think that there's evidence, if you look at Appendix B, the combined civil and forensic escape data, all of our patients in Portland are civil patients, not forensic. And they're, despite the disproportionate share of unauthorized leaves in Portland, we're not in a residential neighborhood, and the issues have not risen to to as high a level as they have in Salem. I would call your attention to the final chart at the bottom of the page there, and page or move your finger down to P1A, which is a particular unit in Portland where we have 22% of the entire organization's unauthorized leaves accounted for on one unit. What I'm suggesting here is that while we're trying to figure out how we get security on our Portland campus and await the review from Silva and Associates, we have a couple of units, P1A and P1B, that we can really zero in on, and we can look at some of the clinical practices that result in patients going out on unauthorized leaves, and we can look at root causes, if you will.
Can one then assume that civil commitments are not dangerous?
Senator Winters, no, I would not make that comment. It just hasn't reached the public level of concern.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Director. A couple of things as people have been talking here have come up. The first thing you mentioned that, you know, and it disturbs me enormously that we've not always had a policy that when these psychiatric security review board patients are missing, that the police are not notified immediately. I'm just absolutely dumbfounded that we would run this type of units and not have law enforcement immediately available for backup when somebody is missing. And so, but in follow up on that, if we're talking about off campus, and you're talking about the Salem campus here, which constitutes what, a half a city block? Okay. My point is a fairly substantial size to the Salem campus. And I think if you're putting a policy in place, and it's just my own perspective on it, you're putting a policy in place that they have to be off campus before you notify the Salem police, you may be too little too late. Because it you know, that person may be missing and still be on campus, the one the size that we have, you know, here. So it would strike me that when someone shows up as missing, that law enforcement is notified immediately, with perhaps the inclusion that we're not sure that they're off campus or however you want, you know, to deal with that. But I just can't imagine, not for the psychiatric security review people, that police are not, law enforcement is not immediately notified. That's all past history, and we're looking for different sort of things, you know, coming, and I'm not going to labor over that, you know, which has taken place in the past. And the other thing, a question I have, when you're talking about Portland versus Salem campus, and we I think I understood you correctly, that they're all civil commitments in the Portland facility versus court commitments in the Salem, and maybe there are some civil commitments in Salem too, is that correct?
Very few.
Very few, but possibilities. Legally, as far as this kind of restraint in preventing access, you know, lock sort of access, what's the difference between the responsibility of the legal obligation, responsibility of the department in relation to the civil versus the Psychiatric Security Review Board court committed?
Co-chairs and Representative Jensen, there's essentially no difference in how they are secured on either campus. They're all locked wards.
So somebody that checks themselves in cannot check themselves out?
You're getting into a level of legal detail that I'll claim I'm not qualified to answer. A voluntary commitment.
Yeah, that's a civil commitment type of. Is it not?
It's
like she's a nose and some whatever it is out there, and the bobbing heads and the body language of the audience.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just concerned about what the distinction is as far as the legal obligation and responsibility of the, you know, between the civil versus the court. I can use the court committee.
We don't make a distinction. Often the public does. That was my earlier point, that the public makes a. We have civilly committed patients who are perhaps only prone to self-harm and therefore not really a great risk to the public if they escaped, if you will, or didn't return from an outing with their family, something like that. We would be as concerned about them as we would any patient. We have civilly committed patients who are as prone to harm to others as harm to themselves. So I think we make our world a whole lot more complicated when we try and make a distinction about the importance of retaining folks on our campus. Could I speak, Representative,
no,
to your other two points?
I think I'm understanding, you know. Thank you.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was glad to hear Representative Jensen's line of inquiry because it struck an issue that I'm curious about as well. It may only be in the minds of the public that there's a distinction, but I'd like to hear the difference between the civilly committed and the forensic. And it's my impression that you don't get into this institution unless you're a clear and present danger to yourself or others, and that some folks are civilly committed in a civil process, and that others are ordered to come by the court because they would be guilty but for reasons of insanity, of serious crimes against others, which resulted in felonious harm. And I'm sorry, if there were 51 incidents of unauthorized absence from the Department of Corrections, we would be looking at replacing the managers of those facilities.
And mostly important, 15
blocks from your house. Yeah, that'd be a reason for concern for any neighbor to a facility. So I guess what I need to know is, at what point in time do you institute a zero tolerance for unauthorized absence, at least among the forensic committees?
Co-chairs Rosenbaum and Courtney and Senator Farioli, I'm not sure how, without additional staff, that we could implement a zero tolerance without just a lockdown. And I think that would be a whole new set of problems for us, given the hospital environment we are and need to be, and the recovery continuing. But I think your characterization is an accurate one of patients who are in our facility with the need to remain there until they are deemed ready to be placed in the community.
Madam Chair, it was disturbing to learn that the facility did not have adequate treatment plans in place for each and every individual who was in the care of the Institute. And we know that that is an absolute minimal standard to comply with federal civil rights and other requirements. But that does not mean, in my opinion, that we should tolerate 51 incidences of people wandering away or intentionally escaping. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, when I read the words unauthorized absence in one place and escape in another, I think that there's a bit of a dichotomy in the institution's understanding about its role of protecting the community while providing this treatment. But in any case, averaging 16 UAs a year is not what I would consider a record that inspires confidence in the operations of that facility.
I would agree, Senator. Let me also say, not to minimize these statistics at all, that there could be, and there are, in fact, in these numbers, patients who maybe tried to run from staff en route to transportation to take them to a medical appointment and only made it 10 steps away. We're going to record that attempt at a UL. And so we try and gather all of that data. We try and be scrupulous in what we collect. So I don't want the committee, and I certainly wouldn't want the public, to think we're talking about 51 elopements, escapes, unauthorized leaves. They're known by different things around the country that were all off campus, unaccounted for hours and hours and hours. But your point, again, is well taken, Senator.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
follow
thank
up?
You. Well, just the idea that I was, I guess, wrapped around the axle of focusing on the forensics, but my good colleagues immediately seated next to me have indicated that there really is no safe assumption that people civilly committed are not a danger to themselves or others, or they would not be in the facility.
Senator Farioli. Senator Courtney.
Yeah, I don't want to belabor this, Laura, but how many patients are there in Portland?
92.
If you understand that if you'd have made the statement about no security involving Salem, you know what would have happened.
I
my life would end probably within 24 hours. And I'm just saying that I think, I don't want to marginalize this in any way, but I think I'm going to have to tell you, you're going to have to do something about that security issue in Fordham almost right away. You can't wait. I was trying to listen to your questions, and thanks to the keen observation and the aggressive questioning center, winners stumble onto this, and thank you for your honesty. But I admit that you've heard, you said it wasn't a residential neighborhood. To me, in Portland, there's no such thing as not being a residential neighborhood. I mean, that's just how I view Portland. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but that's the way big cities are. And so I'm just as sure as you've now finished saying that, within the next 24 hours, we're going to have an incident up there, and then the issue of no security, and here we're going to be in another nightmare. So I don't know what you and Dr. Goldberg plan to do about it, but you're going to probably have to do something about security pretty quickly. That's just my opinion. I can't speak for my Portland people here, but my fellow legislators, and I realize the civil versus the forensics, and you go back and forth, but I think you even acknowledge that individuals under civil commitment can be dangerous, and that what is also, when you look at the fact sheet, vast majority of the unauthorized leads are coming in the civil area versus the forensics. So you're going to... Can you talk to me about that a bit, please?
Coach Courtney, I couldn't agree with you more. I intend always when I talk to this committee to be candid, and
I appreciate that.
I would not candy coat the history we have of providing security on either campus. And I'm by no means met any disrespect to the surrounding Portland. They're both communities, and they both deserve our highest level of security. That has not candidly been the case in Portland. We have moved patients historically. I can't give you details. I apologize for that. But we've moved patients from entire wards from Salem to Portland, and we've not added any staff in Portland. We've diluted the staff in Portland to care for those patients. We have communications staff up there and reception staff, but we don't have.
Are you going to have to
do something? I agree, Sam.
I don't mean to tell you business you're doing. I don't mean to micromanage, but I'm just telling you. I think you're going to have to do something pretty quick. I don't know the magnitude of what you do, but I'm asking you to do something. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Yes, Senator Winters. Just a, and I don't want to belabor it either, but you mentioned that not all unauthorized leaves, some of them can be very minimal and really of no danger. It would be very helpful, I think, that you have some definition or standards, because what's occurring out in the public world or the communities, once you say that's an unauthorized leave or it's an escape, the image that immediately goes up that you're talking about an individual or individuals who could be dangerous. If that's not the case, and if it really is 10 minutes to the bank or something like that, you may want to have a different category than what you currently have so that your statistics really reflect, really what is the true unauthorized leave. Just a suggestion. And I would just echo, since I raised the issue of Portland, or the comments that the President made, that I think all communities, if they have individuals that are our responsibility, that we need to make certain that that community has the staff and security safety community that is needed and necessary.
I agree, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Winters. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I'm sure that the hospital do not, but I just a word for us here to not lose sight of the fact that even though a person is not a danger to others, if they are a danger to themselves, we have morally the same responsibility, if not, well, legally the same responsibility to them, I think, too. It's not just somebody else. If they wind up doing something that injures themselves or kills themselves, we have the same responsibility.
Co-Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Jensen, thank you for that follow-up comment, and I agree wholeheartedly. You made a couple of comments earlier, which I'd like to, if I could, just speak to for a few seconds. I was as disappointed to hear that we didn't have the discipline of the first call to Salem Police as you and as a superintendent where the buck stops. I accept that failure, and I'll accept responsibility for that. You mentioned the PSRB, and I, for the second time this evening, misspoke when I said off our campus, and what I meant there was a distinction between the patient who, while mentally ill, acts on a bad impulse and maybe trots for 10 steps, and our staff secures them, and they return to the vehicle, or they return to the ward, as a distinction between someone who has escaped and is missing. And that was your point, that if someone's missing, we need to be Johnny on the spot. And I just wanted to clarify that we're on the same page there. I sort of misspoke.
Thank you. Well, and obviously this topic is related to the staffing issue, so I think that you also are going to report to us on what's going on with staffing and the update us on steps that have been made toward some goals that have been set. I also want to mention before you do that we have Representative Bruce Hanna on by telephone, and I'm hoping, Representative Hanna, that you can hear what's going on, and if you do have a question, just don't be shy, as I know you're not, and let us know. Okay, let's go ahead.
Co-Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm pleased to talk about staffing. We have many, many priorities at Oregon State Hospital. I would be hard-pressed to imagine that we have any more important priority than getting our staffing where it should be. I would argue it should be our greatest priority in many ways, because so many of our current problems are really manifestations of understaffing. In February, and I use that as a reference point because of the special session and it's my horizon, we had 1,268 employees. Here in September of 2008, we have 1,416 employees. This is pointed out in the information you have in your packet again, which was assembled by our planning, analysis, and research staff I referred to earlier, the great work that they're doing for us. That's a gain of 148 employees with 84 separations or normal attrition that any organization would have. We have a gain of actual hires of 232. The question that often comes up through members of this committee is how many were external hires, how many are new to the organization instead of transfers. 216 of those were external hires, 16 were internal transfers. Again, the total 232. That's in the grid on the front of your staffing impact study report you have in your packets. I would point out that 51 of those total hires are directly related to the Continuous Improvement Plan, or what was originally called the CRIPA plan. 165 joined our regular workforce aside from the Continuous Improvement Plan or the CRIPA plan again. But let me move quickly from what sounds like good news to areas of ongoing serious concern I have, and I know others have on the campus as well, and they are several issues relating to staffing. We continue to heavily utilize agency staffing because our basic staffing numbers are lower than even the minimum should be in an organization our size. Our use of overtime is a reflection of that, and coming now out of these summer months when most of us want to enjoy the beautiful weather here in Oregon or enjoy time with our families wherever we might travel, our mandated overtime, where we place an extraordinary burden on our staff. I know all of you appreciate that our long history of use of overtime has been excessive, yet crescendoed in summer of this year as we tried to deal with issues surrounding vacations, military leave, sick leave, jury duties, educational leave, whatever might have come up. I'd like to just take a moment, if I could, to also point out that we have a number of positions on our campus that someone must be at that post 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Regardless of holidays, and sometimes three shifts. We refer to, when we budget in the hospital industry, and this is probably the case in corrections as well and in other industries, that when we have a charge nurse, let's say on the day shift, on the evening shift, and then the night shift, that all three of those nurses in those positions in the same ward have obviously the benefit and the right to take vacation time. They will get sick from time to time, and they will be absent from that post. If we failed when we budgeted to include adequate numbers of nurses to fill that post, we're forced to turn agency staff or to overtime. And because our basic budget numbers are so low and have been so low for so long, agency staffing and mandated overtime has become a practice at Oregon State Hospital. And it will take us some time to dig ourselves out of that hole, to be candid. Our results in September here, as we're now just about halfway through the month of September, appears as if mandated overtime, which is not fair to our staff. It doesn't allow them time to refresh and return to duty, continues to be a tremendous concern. We have this hydraulic effect, if you will, sort of like the water balloon effect. When I'm pleased on one hand to report that our use of seclusion and restraints at Oregon State Hospital is down 75% to 80%, respectively. And that's an extraordinary accomplishment. And I can't thank our staff enough for that accomplishment. At the same time, the hydraulic effect is that by foregoing seclusion and restraint in the kinds of numbers that we have, we are providing more one-to-one supervision of some of our behaviorally disordered patients, sometimes 2-to-1 and occasionally even 3-to-1 staff keeping a very, very close outside arm's length eye on some of our most behaviorally challenged patients. That's putting our staff in harm's way. And as a result...
I think Senator Winters had a question for you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Senator.
You mentioned that putting staff in harm's way, and it's an issue that I think I have raised at just about every meeting. With adding the new staff, recognizing that you still need to increase staff capacity, have the injuries to staff changed? Are they static? Have they gone down? Are they up? To me, this has been a huge issue out of the state hospital. So I would like some clarity on where we are.
They're up significantly, Senator, and that's in the staffing impact study you have in front of you. Patient-on-patient aggression is not up significantly. Patient aggression toward the facility or equipment, that sort of thing, is not up. It is up dramatically, patient on staff.
One would then assume that our workers' comp claims are up significantly, too.
That could very well be the case.
This is Senator Cornyn was talking about the drumbeat, and Senator Carter, all of us here have had some issues or drumbeats that we have been talking about over a number of years. And this one is one that I have, repeatedly talked about, and the need to aggressively increase the number of staff. I can't say it even more. And one of the things that I think this panel has talked about when we gave authorization for staff increase, what are the barriers? What are the impediments that staff has not been hired?
Co-chairs Courtney and Rosenbaum and Senator Winters, I thank you for your question. There are a combination of events, many of which I tried to get my own hands around in my first 6 months. We all know that there are shortages in the healthcare industry in terms of a number of positions like registered nurses, and particularly the specialized mental health nurses. That's an extraordinary challenge. our history and our reputation of being dramatically understaffed and unsafe in a violent workplace has hampered our ability to recruit. We have opportunities to work out of these things, but you asked Senator Winters about our challenges. We have a number of CNA trained, certified nursing assistant trained folks who get additional training on our campus that make them mental health therapists or mental health therapy technicians. We've resorted to providing our own classes and growing our own, if you will. And between now and the end of this calendar year, we'll have between 55 and 60 additional MHTs on the ground that we're now moving through our educational process. We've even become a testing site. So we're trying to shorten that cycle time as best we can. It has been, again, to be candid, one of my great worries and one of my great frustrations that it takes us so long to fill positions and get people on the ground.
Thank you, Senator Winters. And I do want to point out for the members that I had distributed to you a packet that was prepared by Daniel Smith from the Service Employees Union. And they do have some extensive documentation in there. And they are suggesting, I think, Superintendent, what you just said, that obviously in the necessary reduction of the use of restraints, there have been cases where staff have been subject to violent injury, and that's causing a high level of stress and people being gone from work, and obviously then that just makes the problem worse because it makes it harder to keep people on the job or harder to recruit. So, I mean, obviously many aspects of this are that kind of vicious circle.
Co-Chair Rosenbaum, your clarification is appreciated. I have some culpability in this too, as I've tightened security and I've requested more staff to attend to patients off campus or even around campus. I've put an additional strain on our already limited staff. I wish our path out of our chronic understaffing was more linear and certainly more rapid than it has been, but I will also say I spoke with two of our unions today. They are exceedingly vocal on this subject, as well they should be. Their frustration with this issue predates my own. At the same time, they've been very gracious and they've been very forthcoming with ideas and wanting to work with us in strategies to try and expedite additional staff. And I welcome their help.
Thank you. Did that complete your report for this section?
I might just close by saying, but on this subject, for the remainder of this biennium, I'm concerned about the short-term fixes and those being as quick as we can and make them. But we also need some longer-term and more institutional, if you will, part of our culture, improved means of addressing these issues that have to do with staff aggression, especially toward our, or patient aggression, especially as it relates to aggression toward our staff. And I'd like to just point out a couple of things. One of the things that you approved in the supplemental session in February was the creation of a behavioral psychology service. We're staffing that as we speak, and this is I hope I don't misspeak for the third time tonight, but a SWAT team, if you will, that will specialize in behavioral plans for our behaviorally disordered patients. And I will tell you, we have about a dazen that wreak havoc on our staff. It's not out of our population of almost 700. It's not like we've got 400. We have about a dazen that are extraordinarily difficult to manage. but this behavioral psychology service will, we believe, with their intensity and their focus on this subject, and the psychologists themselves have recently attended an institute for applied behavior analysis. We're looking for breakthrough in that regard. They'll help our treatment teams create behavioral support plans. They'll train our teams, and they'll be available in that SWAT sort of fashion for assistance. I also want to mention that Dr. Goldberg's transformation initiative, I should say DHS's transformation initiative, has started to arrive at Oregon State Hospital, and I'm pleased that it has. We've recently gone through a rapid process improvement effort that has reduced our cycle time, which by that I mean for nursing hires. When a nurse applies at Oregon State Hospital, historically the process from application to an actual hire has been 80 days. With the help of this rapid process improvement and lean leadership in the transformation initiative, we've now reduced that to 7 days. From 80 days to 7 days. We plan to take that rapid RPI, rapid process improvement team, now to dietary to work on nutritional issues for our patients, eventually to pharmacy, and we're looking for a number of rapid process improvements in the months to come. My last comment is my commitment to adhere to our budget for the rest of the biennium, despite our challenges.
And Roy, I did have one question. I just noticed in the introduction to your handout that in the first paragraph you say, during this time period, the state hospital experienced 165 regular new hires and 84 employee separations. So basically, we're losing half the number of people that you were
Those are
hiring.
Regular hires. We had an additional 51 new hires that were CIP related.
Oh, I see.
So the, pardon me, Co-Chair Rosenbaum, we had a total of 232 hires. It's mm-hmm. the total change in employees column there in that first graph.
And the separations, are they just the whole range
attrition.
Of retirements?
But I, in light of our discussion, I wouldn't discount for a moment in front of you folks that it was frustration mm-hmm. or some of them. But hospitals have a normal
right, turnover, but obviously trying to do everything possible to retain the people that you've got that are trained already is paramount. So, okay, well, thank you for the staffing report, and I think we will be seeing you again toward the end of our agenda. We're getting a little behind time, so members, I apologize that it is warm in here. We're trying to adjust the air conditioning. It doesn't seem to be working. So I think we've got it up and running now. And next we're going to hear an update on the Oregon State Hospital replacement project. I think many of the members of this committee and of the audience were at the remarkable groundbreaking event that took place a couple of weeks ago. And obviously Linda Hammond has been a huge part of getting us this far. So she is the administrator of the project, and we're looking forward to an update.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Linda Hammond and I'm the administrator of the Oregon State Hospital Replacement Project. The project continues to move forward on track, and we are diligently working to achieve our deadlines and to achieve our budget. And since my last update to you, we have had some significant progress. We've completed 4 hearings before the Historic Landmarks Commission and have now moved into the permitting process for the demolition of the buildings on the campus that will allow us to develop the new facility on the south side of Center Street. We've held extensive community meetings ranging from special interest groups focused on areas such as security and building design, and working with community partners and neighbors to discuss impacts of the new facility. And we've also continued with our open house process, and our last process was in building 50, and we had 300 attendees. Those attendees were members of staff, patients, and their families for the review of the plans that we have achieved so far.
Yes, Senator Courtney.
That's a picture of you in the tunnel, right?
Yes, Senator Courtney.
I hear there's a request for many more. You know, what are you going to do about that? You know?
Co-Chair Senator Courtney, we did hold tours on the 13th of September. We held 21 tours. We had 215 people registered, 180 people attended. We're a little frustrated with no shows, but we have looked and we are analyzing right now our impact of that process, both on the operation of the hospital, including the security of having an influx of people move through the facility. And I'm also doing a rough order of magnitude on the costs. Right now, I would estimate, just as a rough order of magnitude, that it cost us about $3,500 that day to hold those tours. We are looking and to see with the waiting list about the priority. You have really, our focus is on constructing the new facilities for you. That tour day was specific to mitigation for the historic, and it was very successful. We are planning a virtual tour, a professional virtual tour that will run on the web and in our museum, that will allow anybody to experience the same sort of tour that we show to people. And we will add to that the virtual tour of the new construction and the final facility when it's completed. But we are still analyzing whether it's...
How many people are waiting?
My last official check was about 600, but there could be more, easily more than that, up to, you know, approximately 900.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
So we had the open day in Building 50 with the 300 patients and staff, and we received extremely good feedback. In fact, many of the patients came with additional questions based on their earlier review, and we've been able to successfully continue to communicate. We also, on July 31st, DHS initiated a state construction summit, where we partnered with other departments, including Department of Administrative Services, Department of Corrections, Transportation, and the university systems, to allow the agency an opportunity to discuss aspects of upcoming construction as a state and how we will work together to look at the impacts of such things as escalation and the need to have adequate staffing for construction, so subcontractors. Availability. It was very well received, and the agencies are working closely together. And we also had Jack Kenny, who is the bond manager for DAS, attend, and it was very productive. On September 3rd, you did mention, Co-Chair Rosenbaum, we had the groundbreaking event on the campus with approximately 300 in attendance, and we have received very good feedback from that event as well. In the development area where we are right now, we have moved into looking at final documents and evaluation of the program design, how we compare that to the original master plan, how we look at the footprint and ensure that we are meeting the needs not only of what we are developing now, but we develop a facility that can be as adaptable for the future needs of the state of Oregon. We recognize we don't do this very often, and we need to spend adequate time evaluating where we are and how we move forward. And we also, as part of that, we undertake an extensive value engineering process where we bring in independent consultants to look at what is being recommended by our contractors in the way of not only construction but layout, and look for opportunities to ensure that we're maximizing all savings while ensuring good sound program design. We need to be able to mitigate any escalation or any other increased cost as much as possible to get us to our budget. That being said, I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Hammond? Yes, Senator Winters.
I just have a very quick one, because it was something that was in the paper recently. I know that there were some neighbors that had questioned the transitional part of the project, the cottages, and the use for transitional service. And I was struck by one of those who were complaining about the use of the cottage,
of individuals who had moved in the neighborhood within the last year or two. How are the talks going with those individuals with respect to the transitional plans for the rest of those cottages?
Coach,
and for the record, I just need to state this, so those who don't know, those cottages have been used in the past for that purpose. So I don't want anybody to think that this is kind of like brand new, because it isn't. No.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, we had a meeting just last night with the individuals involved in attendance and other neighbors in attendance. We have also had other meetings with them, and we've opened dialogue, and we have, I feel, being very candid and open with them. And what we've asked them to do is to continue to meet with us and continue discussions and to listen to their concerns and ensure that we have open communication and we offer them every opportunity. And to also look at the dichotomy of having multiple differing opinions, because one of the specific, I'll give you an example, one of his specific requests was, please put fences around the campus. And when I explained to him that he wanted to know why we weren't doing that, when I explained to him that this has been a very strong response from the community not to put fences by around the campus, that they enjoy the campus as it is. And we do have people who feel safe enough to even consider this a park. We do respond to that this is the state hospital campus, and we will work to continue and maintain the open feel of the campus. It's important for the community and important for our operation. So he is becoming, I would say all our neighbors are becoming better educated, which is an important component of allaying their fears. But we will not hide from them. We will continue to discuss those topics with them, and we will listen to some of their recommendations, and if they prove to be of value and prove to be viable, we will look at implementing them.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for the update. Next, we'd like to call Mickey Logan from the Department of Justice. Mickey is going to give us an update on what is going on with the negotiations with the U.S. Department of Justice. Although I perhaps misspoke, I know you can't tell us exactly what's going on, but if you could just give us a status report, that would be great.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rosenbaum, Co-Chair Courtney, members of the committee. I am Mickey Logan. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General. My report tonight is very, very brief. Last time I was here, I told you we're negotiating with USDOJ. We continue to negotiate with USDOJ. The fact of the matter is we've reached agreement on almost every substantive issue, but the procedural issues, as you might imagine, are sticky. The same one that I told you about before, they would like us to have a court order, court monitoring the agreement, and we'd like the agreement to not be supervised by a court. Their other issue that they feel very, very strongly about, still, understandably, is that they would like the agreement to reflect some concessions by the state about community, and I doubt that they will drop that demand, and the state of Oregon is seriously considering We're trying to meet them partway on that because we do want to reach a settlement, and it's hard to not talk about the community, at least in terms with the hospital, of discharge and transitions and not having people cycle in and out and the topics that do relate to the hospital. I don't know where that's going, but I'm hopeful we'll reach an agreement. I have to say, all of our discussions with the USDOJ and the fact that they have not sued us already, it really has been because the state of Oregon has, including you folks, the people at the hospital, DHS, and my office, have really tried to be trustworthy and transparent and forthright with the USDOJ, and they have responded accordingly. Tonight, listening to all the previous speakers and looking at the documentation that you've been provided by SEIU and by Superintendent Orr, and listening to all of your questions, there seems to be a pretty apparent theme, which is staffing. And so when I say that the USDOJ has frankly, gone out on a limb a little bit and trusted Oregon to be taking care of its problems, because we have made some progress. If staffing issues really aren't addressed, it's going to be hard to make more progress. They're smart people. They know that. I mean, if you look at their report, it's there. If they don't see progress, I don't want to pretend that the lawsuit still couldn't happen. I'm hopeful it won't. I'm hopeful that progress will continue. But no matter how much we agree on substantive issues, unless we show them that we're actually making change, they will have feel, I think, at some point. And, you know, I have to say the lead attorney for the USDOJ has called me and expressed a great deal of concern about what he's reading in the newspapers about elopements and other assaults on staff and other issues. And so they are. They're not going away. They're going to be watching us for a long, long time. We would like to memorialize the things we've agreed on. I'm hopeful we'll do that. I can't promise we will, because the sticking points that remain are pretty significant, but they are how to monitor, how to memorialize. We are going to try to come towards them on the community issue. They've certainly come towards us on that. They initially were asking for a lot about the community, and now they've tapered that back. So that's it. That's where we're at. And it's moving slowly, but they want it to move faster. We want it to move faster, and I'm hopeful it will.
Thank you. First, Senator Carter.
Can you tell me two things, and they're basically wrapped up into each other? And the first one is, do you feel somewhat more confident in representing us when you go in defending us as you represent us with USDOJ? And does having this committee give, you think, USDOJ and you a bit of confidence regarding our really trying to fix the problem?
Co-chairs, Senator Carter. There's no doubt that the state hospital receiving attention from the legislature, and this is a pretty august group, has been helpful in many ways in my negotiations with the USDOJ. It does make me more confident. That is not to say, however, that the USDOJ will lose its faith in Oregon if there isn't a particular committee at the legislature paying attention. I would hope that that somehow the legislature will continue to convey, however it would do that, that it's not going to sort of say, okay, our job, our work here is done, and move on. Because there's always a lot of needs. You guys have a lot of agencies, constituents, issues drawing for your attention. I'm hoping that the sun is not setting on the attention towards the state hospital, because it will need attention for a long time, and the USDOJ knows that. Is that responsive to your question?
Yeah, it is that. And Mr. Chairman, shall I say, Madam, Mr. Co-Chair, that my concern would be that this committee represents an interest in what is going on at the hospital. And it also represents, I think, to USDOJ and to our own department that we take it very serious and we want to fix the problem. I'm not so sure what the effects of this committee going away would be. What does it signal to USDOJ that this committee is not here? And I'm concerned, Co-Chair, that even though this is the last meeting, I don't think it should be considered a last meeting, but that the meeting is just adjourned and there would be something in place that people will know that we're serious and we're paying attention. The other thing is, I think it has given the state employees a sense of relief. And I do worry about them, because our state employees work very, very hard. And as Senator Winters has always said and asked questions about what is going on. And I think we have issues still looming around the edges, like mandates and people being forced to work overtime, because that's what we have to do. We just haven't had the money in this state. You know, nobody's trying to be malicious. It's just that that's the way it is. And so I don't know. When I talked the day we had the groundbreaking ceremony, to listen to the employees talk and to listen to them laugh and say, this is good, this will be a good meeting, I just think that this committee serves a purpose in more than one way. And I was just wondering, would staying here or having a committee in place bolster the confidence of our Department of Justice as well as U.S. Judiciary?
Co-chairs, Senator Carter, I really think it would be presumptuous of me to make any sort of push one way or the other for you folks. I'll reiterate, it has been very helpful. It has been helpful. And I can't disagree with anything you've said.
I know you don't want to do the key to court. We'll take it. No.
I think you already have.
And Senator Courtney, actually, you are next on the list.
I had a question, but a certain individual to my right would clear that question. I would like to refresh my mind. What do you mean by a community? Like, what do they want in the community thing that we need to have tomorrow? What do you mean by that, please?
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Courtney. As you probably recall, no doubt you recall when I was here at the last hearing, I explained that we've been holding a very firm line that the I in CRIPA stands for institution, and we couldn't make promises in any written agreement to the U.S. Department of Justice that we would resolve the Olmstead issues, if you will, the Americans with Disabilities Act issues, the PSRB placement and the community issues that they did talk about in their findings letter. They raised those issues in their findings letter, and we have said that topic is off the table. And they continue to push that topic because, from their perspective, which is understandable from their perspective, mental health treatment, I can't disagree with this, is a continuum of care. And talking about the hospital in isolation is not going to necessarily take the state of Oregon where it needs to go from their perspective. We've been drawing a very firm line in the sand. So they've heard us, and they've come towards us on that. They said, okay, you want to tie it to the hospital because of the I for institution. So they've started talking about it now in terms of what does DHS and the state hospital, what do they do to transition folks appropriately into the placement, into the community, discharge planning, if you will. And I think the state of Oregon is inclined to meet them halfway on that regard. I'm not sure that's where we'll end up, but I think we're more likely to bend on the community issue than on having a court oversee our agreement issue.
Is Junction City part of where you are? Are they watching the Junction City?
No, they're not. Not as of yet.
Thank you, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and my question or my issue is one that Senator Burton brought up, and that you've spoken to. I hope DOJ is not in the room because the representative from Eastern Oregon will probably side more with them and encourage them to dig in on that issue. I've been concerned, and I think many people know this, Mark Goldberg knows this, about the whole community issue and the services provided and the interrelationship between hospitals and those services out there. And, you know, we can pump all the money we want into the hospitals, and if we fail to have the interrelationship that's really necessary between the community and the hospital in the movement or the treating of these individuals, we are going to fail as such. And I've been very concerned with our focus, and it seems often to me the agency's focus is, you know, just on this big hospital. And I understand the need for it, and I understand, you know, all of those sort of things. But if we don't do the job correctly in relationship to how the community, you know, fits in, we're going to lose the war on this. And so I'm encouraged, not that you made some ground there, gained some ground, you know, but I'm encouraged that that's an issue that's being seriously discussed.
Co-chairs, Representative Jensen, I think I should reiterate that another reason that I stated at our last hearing that we've been reluctant to make promises about the community issue, and that is we have been really upfront and honest with the USDOJ, and we've tried not to promise anything we couldn't do. And in all honesty, the community issue is going to be really hard to resolve, and I don't know that anybody in this room is going to resolve it. At least I'm not resolving that issue. So I try to not make promises I can't keep, and that's been a problem for us. It's been a big problem for us.
Thank you, Madam. And I genuinely appreciate that. And I'm not in any way minimizing the difficulty of this, and I very much appreciate, you know, what you've done and where you're at with it. But I would be remiss with where I've been before in this committee and other places on this kind of whole issue if I didn't say that this is an integral part of treating the mentally ill in our society and in our state. And if we don't do the job correctly, we may wind up in a situation not unlike what we're in right now with the hospital, and under some big heavy hammer. So it behooves us to try to find solutions to this. Enough said. I appreciate it. You know.
I very much appreciate your comments. I agree.
Thank you, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The initial report that all of us received, I think, created a pretty indelible impression on members of the committee and others who read it. And what keeps coming back to me are three issues, and one is the treatment program for each client produced in a timely manner. The issue of the use of restraints, both chemical and physical. And then partly the issue that you've been discussing when you refer to community, which is timely release. Those are all actionable. And I guess what I'm looking for is some assessment as counsel in this issue that those areas are being addressed.
Co-chairs, Senator Farioli, you know, absolutely, that first issue of treatment plans, I can say with great confidence, has been a number one priority since even before the USDOJ's report was issued. Our national consultants, Dr. Skeller and Dr. McLaughlin, have been pushing that, and I can say with great confidence that the folks behind me have heard that message and have been received a great deal of training, and there have been a great deal of changes in that regard. So in terms of that, the treatment plans issue, a long way to go, but it's come a long way since they were here in November 2006. So that particular issue is confident about. The second issue you mentioned
is restraints,
and as you heard from the superintendent, I feel I have good reason to have some confidence in the issue of seclusion and restraints. It's gone down tremendously. Other issues have gone up, but those weren't, as you point out, those weren't the USDOJ's specific concerns. Not that they wouldn't be concerned about those issues, but those weren't their issues. The third issue, as I indicated in my response to Representative Jensen, of community issues, is the intractable issue that I don't have a great deal of confidence about. I have a great deal of hope, idealism, and knowledge about that issue, and I do know that there are a lot of very good people in the state who are now putting their attention to it, which gives me a lot of hope, but I don't know that I have a huge amount of confidence on that particular issue yet. But that's not to say that the state hospital and DHS aren't working on it, because a lot of people are now. A lot of people in this room are, both in front of me and behind me. So I probably will, I'm hopeful that I will be more confident on that even in 6 months, when the legislature starts considering bills and other things start happening. I'll probably be in a better, stronger position. That's my hope.
Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, I think there's a short, relatively organic feedback loop here, that if the folks in the institution are recommended for transition to a halfway house, and we have let the folks at halfway houses sort of cherry-pick the inmates or the patients that they would accept, and left others who are deemed ready to be transitioned in the institution because nobody will take them, that puts us in a position of having done an awful lot of work, which is measurable progress, but we're still going to be defendants in a CRIPA case, and we're still going to be civil defendants in a multi-million dollar award at some point in time, money that should be used to solve the problem rather than to mitigate damages. So, you know, if we're not willing to understand that there is a role that we must play in a stop-loss mechanism that will cause us to do more, then we're not seeing the picture. And unfortunately, what will happen is that it won't be the DOJ that loses tolerance. It'll be a client of the institution that seeks redress. And that will collapse this effort. And at that point, DOJ has, you know, whatever generosity of spirit they've indicated, you know, is a nice gesture, but it will not protect us from liability. Just my observation.
Thank you. Representative
Clark. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. We're really, I think, honing in a lot of what I wanted to ask about. So there's the first piece about people being delayed in their discharges because of lack of capacity to go to. And I think we just talked a lot about that. And then the thing that keeps me awake is in that first master plan report about, you know, we're building 1,000 beds, but there's going to be another 1,000 people projected to be eligible, that will be, in one way or the other, needing a space in our mental health system, and all of that is projected to take place in the community. We've invested, you know, $500 million in buildings and quite a lot in staffing, you know, in a short period of time. I think we put $9 million into that other 1,000 so far. And so it seems to me with the short-term issues that we're talking about in terms of, you know, discharge release dates, where people were ready to be discharged and nowhere to go, and then this longer-term thing, where does the other 1,000 patients go that are supposed to arrive by the year 2020 or something like that? It seems to me like, back to Carter's original point, is this committee needs to continue to exist. That might be what it needs to focus on. Or that the appropriate legislative committees need to really hold hearings on just that topic alone, because I'm comfortable with where we go next on this, the board of directors conversation, but they can't do anything to help with that part. That's only really the legislature driving that process. And it seems like it would help you with DOJ if that was where we committed to, you know, next, if we end up folding this committee and rolling things into a board of directors or a board of advisors, which was the next conversation.
Co-chairs, Representative Clem, again, I think it would be presumptuous of me to have any say about who meets and why. And I can say that I was invited to speak, and I did speak in July in front of a work group, PSRB siting work group and gave a presentation about fair housing laws, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Olmstead case, and those. So I am knowledgeable about those issues. And if anyone at the legislature, regardless of whether it's this committee or anyone else, wants me to provide a copy of that PowerPoint, I'm happy to do that. But I wouldn't presume to have any say. I don't want the sun to set on these issues. However the legislature and the state of Oregon wants to make sure that it continues to address these issues is fine by me.
Madam Chair, and I don't know whether I should wait and then ask for her opinion after we hear the next presentation, but this is about the Board of Advisors, and I would like to have her opinion on a particular...
I think that would be fine, because I believe you served on a committee that helped put that proposal together.
Yeah, an informal group, yes.
So I guess my question is, do you believe that there is any distinction in terms of what the feds are looking at, you know, for sort of ongoing oversight between Board of Advisors and Board of Directors? In terms of, you know, the advisory nature of some of our boards versus more of a governing, the actual rulemaking authority, et cetera, et cetera. Because I'm not sure what the proposal envisions yet, but the Board of Advisors jumps out at me versus directors. And I've served on state agency Board of Directors, and I'm familiar with advisory boards, and they're very different.
Co-chair is Representative Clem. I don't think the USDOJ wants to or would even opine an opinion about how Oregon should make sure that things are moving forward and in the right direction at the state hospital. I feel confident that the USDOJ would say, you know, you in Oregon, you folks have to figure out what's going to work for you. Well, all they want to see is that good things are happening and that the change they have identified that needs to happen does happen. So they're not going to express an opinion, I don't think, about those types of things. As to the board, however it's called, whatever it's called, I really feel like those are some policy decisions, again, for DHS. And as I've maintained at all the hearings I've been at, I'm not a policymaker. I just know the law. That's all I know.
And we're very glad of that. Thank you. Senator Winters, I know you have a question, but I wanted to just ask one thing. I would assume that if we're successful in settling with the federal DOJ, and even in the absence of a court order, which for good reasons we're trying to avoid, they're not going to just completely now forget about us and never darken our door again, that they will be continuing to monitor what goes on here. Is that true?
Co-Chair Rosenbaum, that is absolutely true. And they're going to be watching us for a long time. They also do monitor all 50 states. I mean, that's what they do. And there are problems in other states that are so dramatic to them at a given moment that that's why they need us to come up with an effective way to monitor ourselves and keep things moving. They want us to be a self-sustaining state that will be able to, an organization, if you will, that can identify its own problems and fix its own problems. Now, not everyone at the USDOJ has that philosophy. We are fortunate that the attorneys we are working with have that philosophy and are, again, I to get back to my main point, they're trusting us right now, but they're not stupid people. And if we don't make changes, if we just say things but we don't do things, there's no reason for them to trust us.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a very quick question, because we were talking about community involvement, we're talking about DOJ and some of its concerns. Is one of their concerns, or are they looking at the problems and many deaths that's around mental health in Portland? Has that risen as one of the levels of their concern or not?
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, they have not discussed that particular issue with me. Having said that, I am quite certain that they are monitoring closely everything that they read about. I get a phone call every time Oregonian, a statesman or somebody writes an article about the state hospital system in Oregon. It's not just the media. they also have their advocates, and there should be. There are a lot of good advocates in Oregon who, I'm not the only person communicating with the USDOJ. So they're well aware of what's happening in Oregon, and it really is because we have been negotiating in good faith and being transparent that they haven't felt the need, I think, to raise every single thing that they're watching to me. But they could, and they will if that becomes necessary.
Just a quick follow-up. Then they're also probably very, very much attuned to not only Oregon, but the rest of the 50 states and the community issue, not in my neighborhood. It's not unique to Oregon. It's nationwide. As we talk about community treatment programs and the difficulty that states, and ours included, will have in convincing the general population of the need and the validity of getting into community mental health and providing some of those resources.
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, I just might add that they're well aware of the barriers and obstacles, including NIMBY, that every state faces. But the lens they have to look through, because it's their mandate, are the civil rights of the patients in the system. And the problems and obstacles are our problems, not theirs.
Well, thank you very much, Vicki, and thank you for continuing to diligently labor on behalf. Hopefully, good news to come. And the final item on our agenda, members will remember that at our last meeting, we discussed the possibility of creating some sort of community board for this hospital and asked Superintendent Orr to think about that and talk to people and come up with a proposal, and I believe he has done that. So if you would come back, Superintendent Orr, and also Bruce Goldberg, if you would join him, we'd love to hear what that's about. And then members, we are, I know, running a little behind schedule. I'm hoping people can be here perhaps until 7:15, so if you can have closing comments from members of the committee. Please go ahead.
Co-chairs Courtney and Rosenbaum, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg, the director of the Department of Human Services. I'll be brief and then turn things over to Mr. Orr. Last time when we met, the issue of an advisory board was raised by Senator Courtney as well as by myself. This is certainly something that I'm very supportive of. As a result of that, asked Mr. Orr to pull together a small group to help provide some advice and input and to begin to put together some of the details about what such a proposal would look like. That's been done. A small work group was formed with five individuals who I believe you have their names in front of you. That group has met several times. I think they've come collectively to a recommendation that we certainly form a community advisory board to provide advice and input. And I think speaking to Representative Clem's concerns or questions, and I think there are still to be worked out a lot of details as to the absolute charge, the membership, and some of the roles and responsibilities, who would appoint those individuals. But those discussions have begun. They've begun to come forward with a proposal that I hope in the next month or two we will formalize. It's my intent to certainly move forward with that. At the same time, I think that there is a desire both from the group as well as from myself to codify that in statute, which I think would be most appropriate. And over the next 2 months, certainly we're beyond the time where, as the executive branch, we can propose legislation. But I would hope with some confidence that as we continue to work out more of those details over the next month or two, that we would find the appropriate sponsor for that type of legislation to be passed during session. So With that, what I'd like to do is turn things over to Mr. Orr to be able to walk through some of the discussions and some of the issues that have been raised and where this proposal is in terms of development.
Thank you. Please go ahead, Lorraine.
Co-chairs Rosenbaum and Courtney, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Roy Orr. I'm superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. It is a pleasure to bring the product at your request from the last meeting for your consideration this evening. It takes the form of a brief memo. I chose to provide an additional page behind that two-page memo to give you some sense of the committee. It's in the back of your packet, as Co-Chair Courtney, behind the final blue divider. Two-page memorandum to Dr. Goldberg and to you, committee members, and a page that shows proposed committees that the work group has considered, as well as relevant applicable statutes that Senior Assistant Attorney General Logan provided for our consideration. Let me say, first of all, that the practice of having community boards or boards of directors is a very common practice throughout the country. Research on that subject was conducted by our QI staff and by Senior Assistant Attorney General Logan through their networks. In fact, in the western states, it's essentially all hospitals have such a board. And as a relative rookie to state government, I'm not sure language whether to use directors or advisors, but irrespective of the language, let me assure you that the tone and tenor of the work group and my strong feeling is this is not purely an advisory group and in no sense a rubber stamp group. This an observation that makes this particular undertaking very important to me is that I sense, and there always will be to some extent, a disconnect between those who are advocates on behalf of our patients and our ongoing operations. But the disconnect is greater than it should be. And I welcome members of our various publics, consumers, families, peers, to be involved in this community board to provide input at the most important levels that the board then at committee levels, such as you see in one of your handouts, and that the board can then consider and amalgamate into a plan, an operating plan of priorities that will move this hospital consistently year after year after year well into the future to the world-class organization that Dr. Goldberg envisions. Members of the committee are pointed out, as Dr. Goldberg said, on the second page of the memo. I would also call your attention to the brief recommendations down below. We do envision this being codified in statute. If we could get the support of a member of this committee to bring it forward to the legislature, then we would put this formal structure together so that we would have a legislative concept to go in time. We envision a board that would be appointed and that a certain gravitas or a certain importance is given to serving on this board, whether those appointments would come from Dr. Goldberg or from the governor. And again, I would call your attention to the committee structure, which could evolve over time, particularly given the fact that we will have a historically unprecedented physical presence with a hospital in Lane County in the not-too-distant future. So I believe you had distributed for your consideration letters from Mr. June Deff, who participated in our work group, and from Megan Cahay, both of whom are available here tonight, and their participation in that work group and their presentation of letters of encouragement are appreciated. I'm available for your questions.
Thank you. thank you very much for the proposal, and I want to also thank both Megan and Bob, because I think although we did request this proposal, that this idea had been proposed and advocated strongly for by the advocacy community before this committee was even formed. So obviously it has strong support from people that represent the patients and the family members too, and I think it's a great start to something that would be a really valuable and permanent contribution to making sure that we stay involved, but that the community and the state stays involved in what's going on at the hospital, and not just at times of crisis, but ongoing. So, yes, Senator Courtney.
You don't have the word yet, right?
No.
Well, I really would like to get the word as soon as you can. The immediate legislative draft, the extent we can do this, I'd like to have a three-session file, and it should be a committee bill, is what I'd like to see happen. No. And the hell of the reason I think we're going to work again, we haven't agreed to this yet, to make sure that the next session is perhaps as short or, shall we say, the same duration of our other one. So I don't want to get caught, gentlemen, in the middle of the session trying to draft language. You can always amend language, so I must tell you that to the extent that you can come up with language. Let's say, Council, I'd like to see a pre-session file as a committee bill. So I'm just going to say that straight up to you.
Senator Courtney, members of the committee, would December 1 be, by that date, be sufficient time to pre-session file?
No.
When would be?
No. We need to get the... I can't just tell the legislative council, we don't have that. Stop everything and just do this. That's not fair. There's requests coming in from all different members and different groups, and they are under the... We do have a fairness system there, and to the extent... You get the request in, and then they can start to work on it in those time frames. So that is too late.
When would be an appropriate...
Well, tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be a jerk about this. It's not like the bill can't be subject to amendment. Not that you just throw it together. Obviously, you're working very hard. I really am sensitive to all the input you're getting. I want to be respectful of that. It's the middle of September. I really feel that you got about a month, and that's about it. And then we got to make we put the request in. However, we're going to do that. We'd like to share in this, and that's why I said a committee bill is the way. Pre-session file. So here we go.
Representative Jensen was next, but would you mind with Senator Ferriola?
Not at all.
Comment. Please go ahead.
Thank you for your consideration, Madam Chair.
All we really need is the outcome. If you can describe the outcome, LC can come up with one. And it would be much better to burden them with the task than your staff.
Okay.
The outline could be there, and the bill always could be amended to fill in some details.
There's dozens and dozens of advisory boards and commissions, and LC knows well how to draft that. If the question is simply... appointments to that board or nominations to the board for confirmation, that's also something that we're well familiar with. So just provide the outcome that you wish to achieve, and LC will give you the line.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I think the conversations that from Co-Chair Senator Courtney and my good friend from over east of the mountains agree with what I was concerned with. I think Senator Courtney's idea of having it as a committee bill, I think that's would be the appropriate thing to do. I think it makes it a little easier in some ways as the bill proceeds through the process if it is a committee bill. And of course, the bill can be amended, even after the original bill is enacted, it can still be amended in subsequent legislative sessions. So I don't think I'm not so worried about some of that as the idea and the concept that you're dealing with, that we're dealing with. In this regard, I also think, and this is not to the panel, but instead to our leadership here, the co-chairs, that the life expectancy, if you wish, of this particular group or committee, you know, that it would be, it seems to me, be appropriate that this group of people, as legislators, if it were possible, would be the ones who would look at this and shepherd this bill through, because we've had quite a bit of effort and education, if you wish, on this topic over the months, and we'd be in a good position to be the shepherds of the bill as it, if you wish, proceeds through the process. So, and that's something for leadership to think about, but very encouraged and get as soon as we possibly can to get to LC.
Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I think it had been our intent to try and perhaps flesh out many of the details and gain some consensus and vetting before doing this, hence the timeline. I think that we can very quickly get you something that could be put into a legislative concept by October 1, with the understanding that some of the wordsmithing and some of the needing to gain, I think, some consensus amongst a variety of stakeholders can continue to take place as that's being drafted, and then we can come back to it and amend that language if that would be okay with the committee.
That sounds like that would be great, and I think interpreters would probably work.
So we can get a concept in with the understanding it's not a final, but that we will refine it from there.
And I know from a previous meeting I had today with Legislative Council that they certainly, although they're, as usual, overworked and overwhelmed, they are prioritizing things that they're directed to, so I'm sure we would get it back timely. Representative Clem.
Just briefly on this question of sort of governance, and I have particularly strong opinions on this, and I've been through, even though I'm a rookie here, one session of negotiating multiple independent board of directors for school and deaf and blind and our food policy council, which we didn't ever get to law, but we finally got agreement on what that should look like. So, you know, there's a line in its letter that says, you know, that is to say that it must not merely advise, but must have true power to affect policy and decision making. You'll find in sort of board politics significant interest between advisory and board of directors. I would take a look at the new School for the Deaf, School for the Blind board of directors, independent board of directors, maybe as a model. I prefer board of directors. You're going to hear probably some pushback and feedback from the governor's office, their views on advisory versus. I've had those conversations myself a number of times, so I would argue for board of directors. It also allows the legislative process, if our upper chamber with the much larger new offices, if they get to confirm the members, it then buys the legislature into these folks as well. So I would, excuse me, I'm sorry, did I say that out loud? That helps. The legislative buy-in for the members of this and the questioning that our senators get to do, you know, either in their big offices or in the out on the committee rooms, it helps get them involved in the board of directors.
Senator Carter.
I feel so confident when we got it down there to make that and to do that, and to see people from this community have been working a long time. I have every confidence that this is not going to be a big deal. I have to tell you. Otherwise, these people would not have been sending reports here that they support the direction to go. I think even those people understand that the people that are on this committee, people like Peter Porter and Margaret Carter, have been on this stuff since 1908. And as we see, I've had a you have a real future that this is going to be so easy. I don't think that it's going to be as troublesome as you might be making it sound like. I really don't believe that. And I think that you guys will listen to each other well. And I think by October the 1st that you're going to have something in the general direction that you're going that will be open to any kind of changes that are necessary for it to happen. And
he's going to just, my God, that the governor appoints somebody, that the treasurer, that the senator, and the speaker of the House appoint somebody, get the hell on and stop making a big deal out of this.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Okay, well, thank you very much for putting the outlines together, and we'll look forward to seeing you.
October 1, to the two of you.
Great. So, members, we are past our time of adjournment, but I would like to afford an opportunity for closing comments from the members. I have a few of my own, and then I'd like to give the last word to my co-chair. So any members wish to make some comments, please go ahead. Senator Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comment, I think you heard it as I was asking questions of Nikki, and that is there is something to be said about having some legislative oversight of this. I was hearing the 80s.
Senator Carter, could you move your mic a little closer? Thanks.
Something
I know we haven't
stealing
my
microphone. I was here in the 80s. We've had quite a few dings in this state. So this is not the first big big scare that we've had. And we get together and take care of the crisis, and then we go on about our business and forget it all over again. Yet we've not built a community system or have built a hospital in as many years, I think about 50 years, and we keep forgetting about this. But we have to remember that this is a dignity of man, person here, if you will, issue, that the most vulnerable in our society is at stake. And I think putting legislators on and in charge and having some oversight make the workers feel good. They even go beyond the call of duty, because anytime you're telling people that you're going to mandate them to work and they still stay there, that tells you where their passion is. And then we have great people who are in charge of this hospital. I just am trying to make a case that until a new board is in place, that this committee does not dismiss itself.
Representative Jensen, just had a feeling you would have some closing comments.
Well, thank you, co-chair. I don't have a lot of closing comments, and I certainly do not. I'm not going to try to be as eloquent as our other co-chair from the Senate is, or is likely to be. I have to extend, quite honestly, I think the appreciation of Senator Courtney and the leadership that I perceive, at least, that he brought to bringing this committee together in looking at the problems and the issues that we have here. I also have to say that it has been very informative for me to listen throughout the hearings that we've had to the commitment that members of this committee have had or have in relationship to the state hospital and to the mentally ill or those people in our society that are perhaps less advantaged than some of us might be. It's been, I think one of the real highlights of my legislative career in what we've been doing here. And I with Senator Carter, do think we've still got a ways to go. I think we'll, follow this through to some further completions. I must express also some appreciation and gratitude to all of the members of the Department of Human Services, DHS, in their
commitment to working with this problem. I think Dr. Goldberg and the others have really made a commitment to making this work. I continue to be disappointed, I guess, when I hear about some of the things that have happened and some of the shortcomings that we've had and perhaps some that we still have. But I think, you know, as a state, we're a long ways down the road from where we were when we first started these discussions with where the DOJ report coming out. There's a good deal greater understanding on the part of, you know, some of the people, at least in the legislature, about the problem, about the issues. So it is encouraging, and with Senator Carter, things come and we do respond to them. It is, however, my hope in relationship to this that the energy that we have generated as a committee will not be something that will be gone, that it will live on even after the members of this committee have long since left the legislature, because this is a problem that's very easy for us to put out of sight, out of mind, and we simply can't afford to do that. The legislature in Oregon cannot afford to do that.
Thank you very much. Any further comments? Any members? Yes, Representative.
Just the opening day of this committee hearing, someone who I'm very proud, especially over this issue, and I was especially proud of the groundbreaking, is my senator. Senator Courtney said, I can't live out there. And from that moment on, I was wondering if and when the concept of, you know, ongoing board oversight would occur, because that's essentially the solution you know, a lot of folks come up with. And a reporter probably called a lot of us right afterwards looking for, what do you think of that idea that day? And I thought it was premature to be commenting on what we thought. We didn't know what was that was going to be. So I'm really glad to see where you're at today with that kind of a consensus proposal coming from the agency and the community. And I feel very honored that this institution is in my district. Considered in any way a liability that it happens to reside in the constituents and the people who live there, and many of the employees are my constituents as well. So I'm honored to have it in my district, honored to have been on the committee, but more anxious in transferring the energy and vitality off to an ongoing monthly meeting style board who can help with the appropriate legislative oversight to support them as they need it. And then, of course, certainly to work with the governor's office to talk you into coming out of the private sector, Mr. Rohr, and Commissioner Special Master. I mean, all of those things needed to be done, not to avoid lawsuits, but to start treating people the way that you know, deserve to be treated and fund the programs and staffing appropriately. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further comments? Yes, Senator
Ferriola.
I was thinking about Ken Kesey's fictionalized account of what was encountered by his protagonist in 1960, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And if you lay that fictional document side by side with a Cripper, read them both, I think you come up with a portrait of disconnection and not so benign neglect. And the reality is that even though we might be very happy to have a board of directors assume some responsibility for helping to direct that institution along a path that brings it into full compliance, but not only minimally required compliance, but sort of the excellence that we would expect in a facility that will be one of the newer facilities in the nation. This agency and this advisory board can never discharge the responsibility that's ultimately the legislative responsibility. So I'll be really interested to see how it is that we craft an interaction between an oversight or an advisory or a board of directors structure, and also include in that a really clear communication to the citizens of Oregon and the legislators that they have a responsibility that cannot be delegated, because it simply isn't possible to delegate that responsibility. we ought to be glad that somebody's willing to help us with the job. And to a certain extent, I won't speak for the executive, they have a similar responsibility that cannot be delegated. But I would agree most wholeheartedly with my colleague from Portland, who suggests very strongly that we not dismiss ourselves until, you know, we are able to hand this off to a standing committee of the legislature in January, or we are certain that we have the structure in the form of the draft legislation to create the advisory board and know how it will interconnect with the legislative and the administrative branches of government. Because we are already interfaced with the judicial branch. So, you know, I just want to second what Senator Carter had to say about sort of staying on task until we're certain that we can hand it off to the full legislative body.
Thank you very much, Senator. Great comments. I just would like to share a few thoughts with you tonight. I have to say, I think it is remarkable how far we've come in this committee. When I think back to the first meeting, and Representative Clem referred to this too, which I believe was on February 1st, and we met at the State Hospital, and I remember feeling sort of a rising sense of almost panic and hopelessness at that meeting, because it just seemed really overwhelming that we were dealing with problems, and there just didn't seem to be, and it really seemed chaotic to me then. And when I look back on the work that has been done, and obviously a lot of it has not been done by this committee or in these hearings, but even in our five meetings, we've really, I think, seen some remarkable things happen in a very short time. And the testimony that we've heard, which has included hours and hours of public testimony, but also, you know, from legislative, fiscal, and the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services, and from the people who work at the hospital every day, who are really, I think, shouldering a lot of the load of what's going on right now, and from the advocates who have made an unbelievable contribution and are continuing to do so, and also from patients and former patients at the hospital. And we've seen, I think, some significant milestones already, including hiring a new superintendent who seems to be good as his commitment to us that he plans to stick with this and still be here into the future to see the fruits of the work that we've begun here. And I think the funding allocations that were made during the February session are significant, as well as the staff funding that is being monitored through the emergency board. There obviously are challenges, I think, I mean, enormous challenges to trying to find people and retain people to do these jobs and make sure that as these changes and improvements are made, that we don't lose the people that are providing care who want to continue to do this work. I think also some of what's not happened over the last almost 8 months is worth celebrating tonight, and that is that we are still negotiating with the Federal Department of Justice, though it may be a long and painstaking process. I think personally that it's a good sign that we are still talking, that we sound like we're getting close to a resolution, which will be one that has some pretty stringent requirements and a plan in place for changes, but that they haven't taken us to court. And I think that's a sign, as Mickey Logan has said earlier, that they obviously have a certain amount of trust in the people that are working to improve things. This hospital obviously has been around for a long time. I did the math, and if it's right, it's 125 years old this year, when it was founded in 1883 as the Oregon Insane Asylum. So I think that, you know, it's not going to take another 125 years, hopefully, to make sure that we are able to have a state hospital that will always be, I think, a challenging place to work and a difficult place to be as a patient, but that hopefully can ultimately be a hospital that we as a state and a community can be proud to have as a place that is an option for even our loved ones when there's a need for them to be cared for during difficult periods of crisis mental illness. And finally, I do want to thank the staff who really have made this committee able to function. Rick Bercobian has staffed this from the beginning, including, I think, remarkably, during the February supplemental session, which was a very challenging time, I know, for him as head of committee services. And we were able to do, I think, two meetings during that month and have one where we took hours of public testimony late into the night, as well as Sasha Pollack, who's on the Senate President's staff, and I know also did a lot of the legwork and outreach to witnesses and made sure that our hearings were well planned, and she's a big part of what we were able to achieve. And finally, I really want to thank my co-chair, Senator Courtney, because it's clear, and I know he hates to be talked about in this way, but it's very clear that his passion and commitment are the reason this committee existed, but even more, the reason that there is going to be a new state hospital, that decision had been made and implemented before the CRIPA report came out. And I think that it wouldn't happen. Obviously, it wouldn't be happening if it weren't for Senator Courtney's leadership. So it's been a great pleasure, even though I know the committee will be meeting at least one more time to consider the legislative concept that I hope we'll be introducing. But it has been a great pleasure, Senator Courtney, to be able to co-chair this committee with you, and I applaud you for your vision and your work. And with that, I'll turn the floor over to Senator Courtney.
All I can say is that when the good co-chair made the open statement, she said, "You have an open statement." And Sasha put together this brilliant sine die open statement outlining what we have accomplished in 6.5 months, starting back on February 1st through tonight, what the committee has done, as well as all the players in the audience have done. And I'm glad I didn't read it, because as a result of the comments and questions of my good colleagues, somewhere in about an hour ago, I wrote a note to the co-chair, because the co-chair and I did come in here thinking this was our sine die. This is what we were going to. We tried to make this a very substantive committee, and we felt that so much work had been done, it was time. And I wrote a little note. She's got my note. And basically what I decided after some 2 hours and 20 minutes, that my statement will be that the co-chair said, "I will have the last word, and my last word is, we have not heard the last word from the Joint Interim Committee on the Oregon State Hospital Patient Care. That the committee should continue in existence into the session, subject to call at this stage of the game. They don't exactly know when we'll meet again, but I do think that we should continue. The committee has heard enough here tonight. Senator Carr started with her question to keep us in existence, and to there are a few other things I do think we need to do, and we'll see how that works out as to when we hand this out over, according to your Senator Ferry, who said in the session. I don't know, and I don't know the committees that we would hand it over to. But we're a pretty good team, and I guess our season's not over. I learned that tonight. And that's my last word is I think we can we'll continue. And thank you, co-chair. It's great working with you, and I hope you understood the nature of my note. It's not that I can't make up my mind. It's that it became very clear to me that some very good veteran legislators here were sending me a very strong signal that, Peter, we need to keep it going. So I listened, as well as the staff. It was hard to read the staff, but Counsel Logan always scares me, because I was an attorney. She said just enough to me to convince me, don't take a chance, Peter. You better keep it going. So that's my final word. Thank you, and we'll see you when we see you. It's co-chair. Thank you. You sure want a good meeting.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. I did also want to mention, I meant to do it earlier, that there was a former activist, a former patient at the hospital, an activist named David Romfrey, who unfortunately passed away during the month of July, and so was not able to see the groundbreaking happen. But we want to remember him and perhaps dedicate our work and our hearing tonight to his memory. And members, with nothing further to come before us tonight, we are adjourned.
Thank you.